Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, the Millennium Development Goals will be the focus of a special session at the United Nations General Assembly next week. Hear why English Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor has urged people to pray and fast ahead of this important meeting. And stay tuned for episode 15 of our weekly radio drama, To the Ends of the Earth. Next week in New York, world leaders, business representatives, human rights groups and development organisations gather to discuss progress on the Millennium Development Goals aimed at cutting global poverty, sickness and illiteracy by 2015. Approved by leaders of nearly 200 countries at the UN back at the turn of the millennium, these ambitious goals were designed to lift people in the poorest nations out of poverty through a mixture of debt relief, increased and more effective aid, fairer trade regulations, and a crackdown on corruption in developing countries. In a message marking the opening of the UN General Assembly, Pope Benedict asked God for guidance and strength to help world leaders carry out what he called the urgent tasks facing the United Nations in the coming months, including the continuing implementation of these Millennium Development Goals and other initiatives aimed at ensuring the human family shares in the benefits of globalization. Among those attending the special UN session next Thursday is Justin Kilcullen, director of the Irish Catholic Aid and Development Agency, TROCARA, and member of the Irish Hunger Task Force.
2 years ago, the Irish government published its white paper on development aid and decided that to make a cornerstone of that, Ireland's response to world hunger. Given that Ireland had experienced famine in the 19th century, that we'd had quite a long history of the implications of that right down into the middle of the last century, and that we felt we could make a special contribution on the issue of hunger. So the task force has met over the last 18 months, and the report will be launched at the UN in the UN headquarters next Thursday. And it's a fairly radical document. One of the things that is most striking about it is the political dimensions of hunger that are included in this. We would say that in Ireland in the 1840s, when there was the so-called famine, that in fact it wasn't a famine at all. It was called the Great Hunger, because there was plenty of food in the country. Why people didn't have it was for political reasons and economic reasons. And in many ways, the same situation prevails in the world today. We know that there's enough food in the world for everybody, but yet every day 850 million people go to bed hungry. And that's because there simply isn't the political will to deal with the problem of world hunger. And what this report is trying to do, besides talking about the need to refocus on agriculture, to put a special emphasis on nutrition, but also says that political leadership must be taken and that people need to be held to account, political authorities, if populations are left without the basic necessities, particularly food for survival.
This is a particularly poignant message, and it's going to be uncomfortable listening, isn't it, for the world leaders gathered there at the United Nations?
Yes, it will be uncomfortable. And indeed, as the task force began its work, there was a commitment made by the members and led by the chair that the report would cause discomfort, because there have been many reports on world hunger that have been of a technical nature, and they have made some contribution to the problem, but ultimately they have never really succeeded in changing the trend. And that is why this is going to be a hard-hitting report, and we hope it will be received in the spirit in which it is intended, and that it will shake political authorities to take really radical action to deal with this most critical problem.
Now, in practical terms, what exactly are you hoping for from this meeting? What is the best-case scenario as to what could come out of this session at the UN?
I think one of the impressive things about the Millennium Development Goals is that they sprung from the Millennium Declaration, which was signed in the year 2000, by over 200 heads of government. Now, this was the first time that poverty had been elevated to that political level. And, you know, quite fittingly to launch the new millennium, that the political leadership of the world was saying, we will tackle this problem of poverty. What we're doing now is assessing progress as we're halfway through the Millennium Development Goals, the most basic one of which is to halve the levels of world poverty by the year 2015. And it's a stock-taking process. And we know that the report is going to be poor. For instance, 40% of people in southern Africa are still living on less than a dollar a day. And for many of the countries, the least developed countries, we will not reach the development goals until somewhere into the next century. So what we're hoping for with heads of government gathering again is that there will be a renewed political commitment to the goals. Because it's one thing for the development professionals to report progress on programs and projects and give us statistics and so on. But it needs the political impetus that is required to really change fundamental things around the level of aid that has been given, how aid is structured, the whole problem of world trade and its relationship to agricultural production, the question of the education of young girls, the role of women, and so on. And it's not too late for significant progress to be made in the achievement of the MDGs if the political will is behind them. So the best case scenario is that the world leaders gathering in New York this week really commit themselves in a firm political resolve that they are going to put the resources into this that is required and look at the structures that are required to deliver the aid and deliver fair trade and debt relief to the poorest countries. Whether that will happen, we will see. I suppose we have seen so many efforts in the past where we have fine words and afterwards the delivery is very poor. That's why many of us from the civil society organizations, the church organizations from the northern and southern hemisphere will be there. We will be lobbying in the wings. We will be attending many events to try and increase the pressure, the moral pressure and the political pressure in terms of whom we represent, to deliver a message to those political leaders that they are being watched, that we expect that their decisions will be realistic and that they will be brave, and that we can hope to see at least the attainment of these basic goals in most countries by 2015.
To underline the urgency of achieving these Millennium Development Goals, the Archbishop of Westminster, Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor, joined the Anglican Bishop of London and other faith leaders calling this week for a day of prayer and fasting ahead of the UN summit meeting. The Cardinal told me he was urging people to pray and fast on Friday as a way of highlighting the important moral dimension of this issue.
The reason why I've called for this day of prayer and fasting is because the importance I attach to the meeting in New York, the United Nations. This is crucially important. When we think of one in seven children in the world's poorest countries will die before their fifth birthday, and one child every 15 seconds dies due to water and sanitation-related diseases. And the world leaders are meeting to discuss the Millennium Development Goals next week. And notwithstanding the credit crunch and all the difficulties that there has been over the last few days, they mustn't renege on this.
There is an important ecumenical and interfaith dimension to this day of prayer and fasting as well, isn't there?
Yes, there is. I mean, this has been done in connection with, other church leaders and indeed leaders of other faiths. It's something that people of all religions will want in terms of help from the richest countries to those who are the poorest. And one reads the statistics of the condition, particularly of children, but of others as well, in the poorest countries. This is an absolute priority. And I think the Catholic Church in particular has been a consistent leader and supporter of debt relief, immunization projects. And I myself, together with the Prime Minister here, Gordon Brown, have been very involved, together with the Holy See, in highlighting this issue.
Of all the G8 leaders, British Prime Minister Gordon Brown does seem to be very committed to making progress on these Millennium Development Goals. What else would you like to see the government there doing to try and keep this at the top of the political agenda?
I think the main agenda on this is the Millennium Goals, and you're quite right to say that Gordon Brown, the Prime Minister of Britain, is foremost in putting this forward. And I think that his voice will be listened to. In terms of the world leaders, I think particularly in the economic sphere, he has great experience. And I think that the fact that he's going, the fact that he'll have something to say of great importance, I think we must back him.
And yet you mentioned the recent credit crunch. We've seen the global food crisis over recent months. I mean, do you think these Millennium Development Goals are still realistic and can they still be achieved in the time we have left?
I remember talking to the Prime Minister about this, and I asked him, why do you need particularly our help? Isn't it an economic thing? And he said, and I agreed, that it's really a moral issue. If people are converted to the idea that we can do this, and it can be done. It's really a question of, I suppose, the hearts and minds of those who can affect these Millennium Goals that need to be touched. So notwithstanding the global credit crunch, which, yes, poses a major challenge to all the developed economies, but we can't forget our fellow men and women, our commitment to the world's poor. And these promises, which were made by the governments, they must be honoured.
My thanks there to Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor, Archbishop of Westminster. And earlier you heard Justin Kilcullen, Director of the Irish Catholic Aid and Development Agency, TROCARA, and member of the Irish Hunger Task Force. And now we present episode 15 of our radio drama, written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua, and entitled To the Ends of the Earth.
Last week's episode told of Paul's vision of the Macedonian and his journey to Philippi, where he converted Lydia and was later imprisoned with Silvanus. How an earthquake opened the prison doors and the jailer was converted, and how the local authorities begged the disciples to leave town. In today's episode, you will hear of Paul's time in Thessalonica and later in Athens, where he uses philosophical arguments to preach the gospel, with little success.
Passing through Amphipolis and Apollonia, Paul, Silvanus, and Timothy eventually reached Thessalonica, where there was a Jewish synagogue. Paul, as usual, introduced himself, and for three consecutive Sabbaths, developed the arguments from Scripture for them, explaining and proving how it was ordained that Christ should suffer and rise from the dead. Some of them were convinced and joined Paul and Silvanus, and so did a great many God-fearing people and Greeks, as well as a number of rich women.
So I thought this would be a good place for your breaking of bread. We used to gather here, my friends and I, for our, how you say, pagan ceremonies. There was a statue of our household god there by the fountain. Of course, I've had it destroyed. How foolish it all seems now, our worship of idols.
It's a beautiful garden. And yes, I think it will be very suitable. Our numbers are growing daily, and Jason's house is, well, very comfortable there, and he's so kind, but it's nowhere near as big as this.
Good, then that's settled. And now won't you come inside and take some refreshment? It's nearly noon and, well, the house is cool. You can rest a while. My servant...
No, please, please, you're very kind, but I must return to my tent making. I have a number of orders. I've built up quite a clientele here in Thessalonica since we came all those weeks ago.
But you must eat. How can you go on like this, preaching and working? Do you ever sleep?
Oh, you get used to it. And I have to earn a living, you know. No one is going to say Paul is a scrounger. Christ himself was a workman, remember?
Yes, you told us. Well, if I cannot persuade you...
Thank you again, madam, and farewell till tonight.
Till tonight, then. You will find the place ready. I shall see that there is bread, wine...
Paul!
Oh, Paul! What's that? I think there's someone at the gate.
Paul! Paul!
That's Silvanus. I must go.
He sounds agitated. I'll let him in.
Silvanus.
Paul! Oh, excuse me, madam. Paul, we must get away somewhere. Hide. There's a movement against us in the town. The Jews, they've got agitators running around stirring up people against us. It looks nasty.
You must take refuge here. No one will know. Where is your other friend?
Timothy? Oh, he's all right. He's down at the port talking to his sailor friends.
It's very good of you to offer us asylum, madam, but we can't possibly accept. It's not right to expose you to such a risk. I have a good friend. He provides me with goat's hair for my weaving. We'll go there. Come, Sylvanus.
Take care, Paul. Farewell.
The Jews, full of resentment, enlisted the help of a gang from the marketplace, stirred up a crowd, and soon had the whole city in an uproar. They made for Jason's house, hoping to find them there and drag them off to the people's assembly. However, they only found Jason and some of the disciples, and these they dragged before the city council.
They're here! They're in our town! These people who've turned the whole world upside down have come here!
Down with the Christians! Yes.
They've been staying at Jason's.
Yes, Jason the Jew, he's one of them now.
They're all acting against Caesar's decree.
Oh, they've got no respect for any of them.
They say there's another emperor. Jesus.
What's all this? Who are you accusing?
These Christians! They've turned everything topsy-turvy!
Where are their leaders? Is this the man?
No, that's Jason. He's one of them now. He's been harboring them. And I expect he's hidden them somewhere now. You ask him.
Well, I don't know.
The city authorities were disturbed when they heard this, and they made Jason and the rest give security before setting them free.
So you think I should stay for a while?
Yes, Timothy. It's the best thing in the circumstances. Aristarchus will help you. He may be a new convert, but he's an old hand already at preaching. And his mother will take care you don't starve, I'm sure. She's been so good to us.
Oh, you can count on us, Paul, and we'll join you in good time. Be sure of that.
You will take care, won't you? The roads are so dangerous at night. Bandits, wild animals.
But none of them are as dangerous as these Jews, Mother. They've really got their teeth into Paul and Sylvanus now. You should have seen them at Jason's. They were ready to tear them apart.
Yes, Jason told us they'd rounded up all the local delinquents.
What a good thing you were here, Paul.
Yes, but now you two must make yourselves scarce.
Here are some provisions for the journey.
All right,
and
thank
water.
You.
And water. Be careful of that.
Goodbye. Sure.
Take care.
When it was dark, the disciples immediately sent Paul and Sylvanus away to Berea. Here the Jews were more open-minded than those in Thessalonica, and they welcomed the word very readily. Many Jews became believers, and so did many Greek women from the upper classes, and a number of the men. When the Jews of Thessalonica heard that the word of God was being preached by Paul in Berea as well, they went there to make trouble and stir up the people. So the disciples arranged for Paul to go immediately as far as the coast. Paul's escort took him as far as Athens and went back with instructions for Sylvanus and Timothy to rejoin Paul as soon as they could.
Spear of Athena.
Is that the statue? The famous statue of Athena?
That's it, sir. Athena, our goddess. When we see the sun flashing on her spearhead, we know we're nearly home.
Must be enormous. I mean, we still have quite a way to go.
70 feet high she stands, sir, no less.
Ah. Lord, if these men can build such splendors in the worship of idols, what will they not do when they know you? We're coming in. There's Mount Hymettus. That's the Isle of Aegina. And there, that hill, those columns. That's the Parthenon.
That's the Acropolis. Yes, and the Parthenon. We'll be in port in a few minutes.
Athens. And then, who knows? Corinth, maybe. The glory that was Greece will be Christ's glory.
Thank you. As Paul waited for the others in Athens, his whole soul was revolted at the sight of a city given over to idolatry. In the synagogue, he held debates with the Jews and the God-fearing, but in the marketplace, he argued every day with anyone who would face him. Even a few Epicurean and Stoic philosophers disputed with him.
Extremely interesting. Tell us more.
Well, I don't know that I could go along with you there. I mean, an afterlife. Epicurus would never...
I tell you, sirs, this is the good news, the news of resurrection. Jesus.
Oh, no, not another babbler. Oh, I fear. Oh, my dear fellow, I'm afraid you've mistaken your audience. We are not your city idler, you know. All ears for the latest gossip.
No. Give him a chance to explain himself. I'm intrigued. This resurrection person must be a goddess, I suppose. Consort of this Jesus fellow.
I don't know why you're so interested. I mean, he's a seed picker. Collects ideas and throws them.
The greatest news is that Jesus rose again on the third day.
Jesus? A man? Rose again? After death?
This parrot doesn't know what he's talking about. He's just a propagandist for some outlandish gods. I really don't think we should waste our time anymore.
But that's what's so amusing. Wasting time is such an exquisite pastime. Admit it, you know you enjoy it.
Oh, if you look at it that way.
Anyway, I'm curious. I think we should hear him in the right environment. Why don't we take him up to the Areopagus? Invite him to speak before the council.
What? Go up there? In the seat?
Oh, no, no. In the evening, after sundown. We'll get everyone together.
Sure. Oh, I've forgotten what a climb it was. Oh, I was sick last time the council met.
So you were. You didn't miss anything, though. Same old discussions. That's why I think we need something new to talk about. Now, this man...
Hey, look, he's coming up right behind us.
Oh, yes. And that's Dionysius he's talking to. I wonder what he thinks.
Well, are you going to ask this fellow to explain himself better?
I will. I say there, Master. I don't know your name.
Paul is my name.
Paul, then. Now, we would like to know just what this new teaching is which you present.
You bring strange things to our ears.
Yes, to us some of the things you said seem, how shall I put it, startling.
Now, I wish to know what these things mean.
Yes, we would like to find out. You understand, we are men of learning, of ideas.
Philosophers.
We discuss, we argue, we debate.
And we love to hear new argument.
Come, friend, speak to us. Speak freely. Out here in the open, away from the city centre, we shall all be able to hear you, and you'll not be disturbed by the uncouth rabble.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Men of Athens, I have seen for myself how extremely scrupulous you are in all religious matters, because I noticed, as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, that you had an altar inscribed to an unknown god. Well, the god whom I proclaim is in fact the one whom you are already worshipping without knowing it. Since the god who made the world and everything in it is himself Lord of heaven and earth, he does not make his home in shrines made by human hands.
Oh,
yes. I see your eyes are all turned upwards to that magnificent building on the hill of the Acropolis, your Parthenon. It's beautiful, those stones touched by the light of the setting sun. But I say, God does not make his home in shrines made by human hands. Nor is he dependent on anything that human hands can do for him, since he can never be in need of anything. On the contrary, it is he who gives everything, including life and breath, to everyone. From one single stock, he not only created the whole human race so that they could occupy the entire earth, but he decreed how long each nation should flourish and what the boundaries of its territory should be. And he did this so that all nations might seek the Lord and, by feeling their way towards him, succeed in finding him. Yet he is not far from any of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. As indeed some of your own writers have said, we are all his children.
That was Epimenides of Cnossus, if I remember rightly.
Yes, but the other line was from Aratus. He was a Cilician.
Ooh, and isn't this man a Cilician? Tarsus, he said. The Cilician Gates, you know.
Actually, Cleanthes, the Stoic, used a very similar language.
Since we are the children of God, we have no excuse for thinking that the deity looks like anything in gold, silver, or stone that has been carved and designed by a human being. God overlooked that sort of thing when men were ignorant, but now he is telling everyone everywhere that they must repent, because he has fixed a day when the whole world will be judged, and judged in righteousness, and he has appointed a man to be the judge. And God has publicly proved this by raising this man from the dead.
Oh, I told you we were wasting our time.
You win. But it wasn't all nonsense. And you must admit he's got all the philosophical tricks by heart.
Maybe. But resurrection of the body. Hey there. Paul of Tarsus. We'll hear you again, huh? Another time. That's enough for the summer evening.
Look. Old Dionysius. He's up there still, listening.
Oh, he's bewitched. I always said he was a bit odd.
After that, Paul left them. But there were some who attached themselves to him and became believers. Among them Dionysius the Areopagite, and a woman called Damaris, and others besides.
Damaris.
Oh, I thought I'd never catch you up.
What is it? Are you all right?
Yes, I'm fine. But you, you're leaving Athens? Dionysius told me.
Yes, Damaris, I'm leaving. I'm afraid Athens has been... I can't explain.
I understand. I'm sorry. We've let you down.
No, you've been great. You and your family, Dionysius, all of you. It's just that... Well, I suppose I was expecting it to be different. But you and Dionysius will be more successful than me. It's up to you now to spread the word.
And you? Where are you going now?
I'm heading for Corinth. But I'll keep in touch, send you help if I can. And now, I must be away.
God be with you, Paul.
And with you, Damaris. Farewell, Athens. You had your chance. And now... it's Corinth for Christ.
And you can hear part 16 of our radio drama To the Ends of the Earth at this same time next week. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.